fasten your seatbelt, and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we take the Highway 10 exit in Stevens Point, and we head east 7 miles to rural Custer, the site of the 19th annual Midwest Renewable Energy Fair, timed as always for the weekend of the summer solstice, when that best of all beacons of alternate energy, the sun, is highest in the sky, with its direct rays illuminating 270 exhibits, 200 workshops, speakers, music, and food stands. Joining us later today on Route 51, Amy Hart, the program director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, and Chris Schneider, a member of the association's board of directors, who is also in the business of selling electric gas hybrid cars. This 19th annual energy fair has taken on unexpected significance, for as we head east on Highway 10, we pass gas stations and convenience stores with signs advertising gasoline at $4 a gallon. A figure most Americans thought would never happen in their lifetimes. The stations and stores that we pass are owned by small businessmen who themselves are seeing very little of that money. In the first half of our show, we welcome Matt Hauser, the president of the Wisconsin Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association, to talk about the high price of gas and the cost to the people who sell it. As always, we will be taking your calls and questions live on the air, toll-free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or if you are calling from the Wausau area, 715-261-6371. That's 261-6371. Matt Hauser, thanks for being with us today.
Good afternoon, Glenn.
And first of all, what is the Wisconsin Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association?
The Wisconsin Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association represents more than 2,000 locally owned independent petroleum retailers throughout Wisconsin.
And do you have people who are members throughout the state, or are you concentrated mostly in places like Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, the big metropolitan centers?
Actually, our members are located throughout the state. Ironically, the independent members you'll find in the more rural areas, because historically, many of the gas stations, some of the more urban areas, were owned by refineries who have since sold the business to independent members. But we're well represented throughout the state. Our members are independent businesses that sell gasoline and fuel oil products. As a matter of fact, they sell more than half the entire volume of motor vehicle fuel. And we also deliver farm fuel and home heating oil. The large refiners that I mentioned, including ExxonMobil, British Petroleum, Shell, and Citgo, they do not own or operate retail stations in Wisconsin.
But there are some large refiners who do, correct?
There's a few refinery-owned stations in Wisconsin. Marathon Oil Company would be one example. Not in the same class as the big four that I mentioned, but I believe Murphy Oil out of Superior, Wisconsin, they also own a few stations and stores.
Do you represent any stations owned by these big refiners?
No, we represent independently owned and operated businesses.
So with $4 a gallon gas, your members, the gas station owners, they must be raking in the dollars these days, don't you think?
Well, actually, Glenn, our members are feeling the same pain as their customers. Most of the time, they're lucky to make a few pennies per gallon.
And why is that?
Well, 70 to 80%, and again, this is historically high, of the price for each gallon of gas is based on the cost of crude oil. As crude oil prices go, so goes the price of gas. Let me give you an example. Today, the wholesale price of gasoline in Wausau was approximately $3.40 per gallon. Federal and state taxes add another 51 cents per gallon. Transportation costs, another penny or two. That puts the price near $4 per gallon. So as you can see, there's not a lot left to cover the retailer's costs of bringing the product to their customers.
What you're telling me is your people are only making a penny or two a gallon for
Correct.
Every gallon they sell?
They hope to make a penny per gallon, penny or two per gallon, excuse me.
Well, how are most of them doing? We've seen statistics that Americans are reducing the amount of driving that they're doing. This of course, is just within the last couple of months or so. But is this situation with the high gas prices causing problems for the small businessmen who own the gas stations?
Well, it's certainly causing cash flow or liquidity issues. Just as consumers have seen the price rise to fill their tanks. The retailer now, when gas was $2 a gallon, a tanker filled with gasoline cost approximately $16,000. At $4 a gallon, that same tanker cost $32,000. So they certainly have to be managing their cash flow. We are seeing demand, I think, nationwide has dropped a few percentage points. And with more of the discretionary income being used up to put gas into the consumer's tank, some of those higher margin items that you often sell in a higher profit margin items that are often sold in a convenience store, whether it be a bottle of water or soda, there's not as much income left to make those purchases. So we're seeing just a little bit tougher times.
How tough are they? Do you have any gas stations actually going under?
Not that I'm aware of at this time.
How big of a problem have drive-offs been, where customers pump gas and then they drive off without paying?
Well, you'd think drive-offs, with the prices being higher, would have been up or would be a bigger problem than what they have been in the past. My members are reporting that, you know, drive-offs has held steady even with the price increases. And I think that's largely in part because of, you know, enhanced security measures, whether it be having some of the low visibility pumps being prepay,
mm-hmm.
or announcing the presence when you turn the pump on, such as pump 5 is now ready. To also, state law was enhanced in 2003. You probably have seen the little blue stickers on the gas pumps that say, you know, if you're convicted of gas theft, there's a possibility a judge could suspend your driver's license.
But, you know, we've seen more and more of that, and I think it's particularly in the big cities more than the rural areas where this just isn't as trusting a society as it used to be. Now when you go into some gas stations, particularly in urban areas, they want you to pay in advance.
Well, you have to remember when a customer drives off with a tank full of gas, that gas was paid for by the retailer, as were the taxes. When you're only making pennies per gallon, you have to sell several tanks full, sometimes a whole day's worth of fuel sales, to recoup what you lost on that drive-off. So that can be a serious problem. Again, though, I believe the retailers have taken good steps to manage that threat. And I also think, you know, shows such as yours, Glenn, is getting the word out that you know, these are independently owned and operated businesses. The people that own these gas stations are your neighbors. So you're not getting back at big oil companies here. You're hurting your neighbors.
And I guess the other question is, how much abuse are your members getting from members of the public?
Well,
you take it out on the guy that you meet face-to-face, or the person that you run into, because, you know, let's face it, the people who are actually running the big oil companies, they're not very accessible to us.
Correct. And, you know, that's part of our members' business is they're branded with a major oil company, and customers see that they're flying that major oil company brand, and the clerks that work those stores happen to be on the front lines and often are the ones who bear the brunt of an upset customer. But unfortunately for them, they have very little control over it.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Our guest for the first half hour of the show is Matt Hauser, the president of the Wisconsin Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association. This is the group that represents the gas station owners across the state of Wisconsin. We are talking about the high cost of energy, and again, in the second half of the show, we'll be hooking up with the folks at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin. I also want to remind you that Larry Mueller will be broadcasting live from the Energy Fair tomorrow, Friday, at 11 o'clock. We invite you to tune in for that, and if you'd like more information, you can check out our website, wpr.org/WLBL. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guest for the first half hour, Matt Hauser of the Wisconsin Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association. Let's go right to the phones. We have Joey in Minocqua. You're on Route 51. Hello, Joey.
Hello. I don't know if it's more of a comment or a question, but I work in Rhineland or live in Minocqua. all the gas prices in Minocqua are $4.14 a gallon, and then just 26 miles away in Rhinelander, all the stations there are $4.04 a gallon. It's just amazing that all the stations in one town are the same, and just 26 miles away, all the stations are another, and they're the same, you know, one brand, one city is the same as...
Well, Matt,
and
why,
it's higher in another town.
Matt, why is that? I've noticed that, too. A couple of weeks ago, I drove to Appleton from Wausau, and I swear the price of gas in Appleton was a full 10 to 15 cents a gallon less than what we're paying in Wausau. Why the discrepancy?
Well, there's a few things. Obviously, there's factors that go into each individual site, be it their volume, where they're located, who they're getting their fuel from, and which terminal in the state they're pulling that fuel from. That all impacts their individual pricing decisions. But to touch on the caller's question as to why communities where you see similar prices is, a retailer is always free to match the price of a competitor. State law requires that we post the price on the pump, and generally in another very visible spot, it's usually a large street sign. So the retailer has two choices there. He can either match his competitor or watch his customers drive to the other gas station. So being just in the way we advertise our prices, it's not all that unusual that retailers would be at the same price in a given geographical area.
So are you saying that that could create the difference just 26 miles away between Rhinelander and Minocqua?
The 26 miles, again, it depends on, you know, an individual location and when they've received their fuel load, when they haven't, the volume the store goes through, and how quick they're turning over their volume as well. It certainly could be that there could be a lower volume dealer that hasn't received the price increase yet from his oil company supplier, so he's working. You might be actually keeping the price down in one community. We're in the community where there's a bunch of high-volume stores, and they're constantly trying to manage their cash flow to be able to pay for that next load. One retailer made a price increase, or another one went down, and the competition followed.
Joy, do you have a follow-up?
No, it's all a tough pill to swallow, but no, that kind of answers my question. Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. And what can consumers do to turn things around, Matt Hauser? It seems like, you know, we're stuck between a rock and a hard place no matter what here.
Well, certainly supply and demand is playing a key role. As I said earlier, demand is actually down in the United States. Our parent association, the Petroleum Marketers Association of America, PMAA, they recently rolled out information pointing to Wall Street speculators who are driving the cost of oil and natural gas to record highs. They're encouraging customers to contact their members of Congress. I think we all want to get these prices under control.
Is this the so-called Enron loophole that everyone is talking about, where speculators and commodity dealers, jack up the price in dealings around the globe? And it seems to be done in high financial circles and not really at the part of the people who are actually pumping the gas.
It's my understanding what we have happening here is there's a number of players in the market that are just, they're making money, they're trading off the volatility. They never physically take delivery of a barrel of crude oil. And it's this sort of activity that many believe is running up these record high prices, not just in crude oil, but across all commodities. PMAA, for more information on this, PMAA has rolled out a national media effort. If I could leave a web link for your listeners, it's www.stopoilspeculators.com. Again, it's www.stopoilspeculators.com. And they're, again, we're encouraging people to contact their members of Congress. And Congress has been listening. I think there's been, just this week, several bills have been introduced.
And those bills do specifically refer to this as the Enron loophole. I can see by just surfing the web here, there's something on the ABC News website indicating that this loophole exempts energy speculators who make trades electronically from U.S. regulation. And there is a bill in Congress right now to try to close it.
Yes, there is. And there's several others being introduced. One thing that some people believe could help bring some regularity to this volatile market is simply take out the traders that can't physically take delivery of a barrel of crude oil. So you close the market down to those people that are actually supplying and selling gasoline and fuel oil.
One thing we've got in the state of Wisconsin, Matt, is the minimum markup law. How does that work and how does that affect the price of gas?
Well, the minimum markup law, or Wisconsin's Unfair Sales Act, actually works to keep robust competition alive and well here in Wisconsin. It's one of the reasons why 8 out of 10 stations are independently owned and operated. And this all benefits the consumer. States without fair marketing laws, such as Wisconsin, generally they have less competition, there's less jobs, and less choice for consumers, and generally their retail prices are a bit higher as well. It's all about preserving and promoting competition, and the consumer is the one who wins.
So you're in favor of the minimum markup law?
Yes, our association has long been in favor of retaining Wisconsin's unfair sales.
Now, not too long ago, there was a gas station owner in Merrill who tried to sell gas at below the markup law's allowable level to senior citizens, and he said to support local sports teams and charities. The state stepped in and stopped him, and boy, he was kind of a poster boy for those who think the gas prices are too high. You're saying that the state probably should have done that.
I was aware of the case. I believe the state sent him, the retailer in question, a warning letter, and then also explained to him the way the law works. Wisconsin's Unfair Sales Act doesn't prevent anyone from offering a senior discount. What it does prevent is from retailers engaging in predatory pricing, and that's setting their price at so low that it takes profits from other areas of their operation to offset those losses. And it's at a level that small retailers, even some of the larger small retailers, certainly can't maintain. And the larger retailers are only going to maintain those losses for as long as it takes them to get the market share. And generally, when that competition is frozen out, the large retailers have raised prices back up, sometimes to levels higher than they've been in the past.
Matt, during the just concluded primary season, there was a big debate about whether or not we needed a gas tax holiday. Has your membership taken a position on that?
We believe that transportation infrastructure is critical to tourism and Wisconsin's industry. And obviously our gas stations are located along well-developed roads for our customers to be able to travel the state and engage in the tourism activities. We believe that there's other problems the legislature and Congress should be focusing on, and a gas tax holiday probably wouldn't be a good fix.
All right, you're not in favor of that because you don't want our roads to deteriorate, since the roads are paid for by the gas taxes.
Yep.
What about ethanol blends? They've been resisted by some people who insist that pure unblended gas is better.
Our members, since the 1970s, we were the original partners to bring gasohol to Wisconsin, and our members certainly believe that renewable fuels play a very critical part in our overall fuel infrastructure and distribution system.
But isn't the demand for ethanol simply driving up the cost of corn, and isn't that just eliminating any price advantage that used to exist?
Well, there's a lot of opinions on the whole food versus fuel debate. I guess the one thing that I would say is I would like to see more research dollars dedicated to cellulosic ethanol, biodiesel.
Is that like switchgrass, different plants?
Switchgrass, biomass, up north where you're located, certainly some of the scrap lumber and downed trees could be used to develop cellulosic ethanol. It's my understanding we're a few years away from having that be a market viable product, but that's certainly an area where I think we could push more research dollars and kind of rid ourselves of this whole food versus fuel debate.
Do we need more refineries?
Well, a refinery hasn't been built in this country in 30 years. I think there's a need for renewable fuel sources, but I think there's also a thought that we should be maximizing the fuel resources that we do have in the most efficiently way possible. And if we build a refinery in this country, it's certainly going to be cleaner operating than a refinery that's built abroad, and it would bring more product closer.
There's also been a renewed push for offshore drilling. Would that do anything for the price of gas in the short term?
I don't. It's our understanding, again, I don't think it would do anything in the short term, but 10 years ago, individuals were probably making the same argument. So, of course, if we had more production here to meet growing demand, you might see some cost benefits. Again, I'm not advocating for one particular method over another. I'm just kind of looking at the big picture and how do we get more fuel, be it petroleum-based or some alternative fuel-based, into the pie.
All right. And, Matt, I'm going to have you answer this question in about 10 seconds because okay. I'm running out of time. Do you think we've got too many grades and varieties of gas, too many boutique gas varieties being custom-made for individual cities to meet individual environmental challenges?
We certainly do. We have approximately 44 boutique fuels, and there's no reason why a fuel that's good for California or a fuel that's good to use in Milwaukee couldn't be good to use in the Midwest. I think there was legislation to try to bring that down to 3 fuel blends in the country. Again, that would certainly help because the refiners wouldn't have to process all these different blends. And
Matt, we are out of time. We are completely out of time, okay. And this half hour has gone much too quickly. Matt Hauser of the Wisconsin Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association. Matt, good luck to you and your members because they need it with these high prices of gas. I'm Glenn Moberg. We'll be back to talk to the Midwest Renewable Energy Association people right after this. I'm Glenn Moberg. We are back on Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin on the Ideas Network. We want to thank Matt Hauser let's get the right name of his organization here, the Wisconsin Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association. Matt spent the first half hour of the show with us talking about how the people who pump the gas, the people who run the convenience stores and the gas stations, are being hurt by this $4 a gas as much or maybe even more than the rest of us are. We're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about renewable energy for the next half hour. It is a big weekend for that subject in Custer, Wisconsin, where the 19th annual Midwest Renewable Association Energy Fair takes place this weekend. We've got Amy Hart, the program director of that organization, with us, and Mick Segrillo of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. And let me get the phone numbers out in case any of you would like to join the conversation at 261-6371. That's 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742, 780-9742. Amy, Mick, how are things going?
They're going great. Thanks for having us on the fair. We're all set for tomorrow.
And it's a big deal. I mean, you've got how many exhibitors? How many displays?
We have over 250 exhibitors and over 200 workshops over the course of the weekend.
Amy, this is the 19th year for the fair, and it's more significant now than ever. How have the record high prices of gasoline increased interest in the event this year?
Our phone has been ringing off the hook for the past couple of months. Last year we had nearly 20,000 people attend the Energy Fair, and the interest is there, and just the growing awareness of climate change, global warming, but especially I think the energy prices is really raising the awareness, and people are wanting a resource to go to for additional information and that education, and the Energy Fair is the perfect spot.
Mick, do you want to chime in? You're the president of the board of directors, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, I am. And just a little bit of deja vu that's going on here. The first energy fair back in 1990 coincided with the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein. And we had an incredible turnout that first year simply because gas prices skyrocketed. My area of expertise happens to be wind energy, and I've never quite understood the public's correlation between the cost of electricity and rising gas prices. But it's good because what happens is it brings people out. They are aware of the fact that those prices are going up. They're out of their control, and they're looking for something to do. They're looking for some way of getting control of that situation again. So it's all sort of kind of interesting the way it all comes back around.
How much, and I don't want to dwell on politics here, but you brought up Saddam Hussein, so I'm going to ask you a political question. How much do you think the Iraq war and the turmoil in the Middle East, How much do you think that's directly responsible for the high cost of gas?
Wow. It's obviously all interrelated. I think that there are probably more things involved than just the war that's going on in the Middle East right now. There is certainly the head-in-the-sand attitude that our political leaders, be they Democrat or Republican, I'm bipartisan on this one, but the head-in-the-sand attitude that our political leaders have had relative to any kind of an energy policy. They sort of took a look at what Jimmy Carter did and trying to develop an energy policy, and they have shied very, very far away from that. And I think we're reaping that right now. We really don't know where we're going. We haven't known where we're going for a long time. And what happens is outside forces sort of they just take control of that, and we lose control of that.
We were told when we invaded Iraq that oil had nothing to do with that, but now we see in the news that the four big refining companies in America are about to get no-bid contracts to drill for oil on Iraqi soil.
Mm-hmm. Makes you wonder.
And I think that just shows the reality of what we're dealing with, and that it's not a number of folks anymore just saying we're getting close to peak oil, we're reaching the end of the fossil fuels, and it's going to be more expensive to get oil. And so now we're coming up with all of these ideas that we thought weren't going to be brought up, whether it's offshore drilling or opening up different areas. And so there's individuals looking at that, but there's also a growing population that's looking at what are those alternatives and what can we get to faster than what our leaders are saying, you know, giving us 10 years to get a higher miles per gallon. Well, we can come up with neighborhood electric vehicles next year and really start rolling out some of these options.
You know, go on, Mick, I'm sorry.
That's one of the things that we do with the Energy Fair here is we try not to dwell on the problems. We all know that the problems exist. And instead of grousing on that and sort of rehashing that, we sort of look at a solution-based, what can we offer people? You know, our feeling here is that education is empowerment. The more you know, the less you're going to pay. One of the things that's sort of interesting, Amy brought up about, you know, drilling our way out of things. We spend an enormous amount of time educating people on efficiency and conservation. And I want to go back to efficiency for just a second. I heard something absolutely brilliant from an interview on public radio a couple of weeks ago, and I don't remember who it was, but they were talking about the greatest oil reserves that we have on the North American continent are in Detroit. What they were actually talking about was, look, we need to get away from driving vehicles that get 11, 12, 13, maybe 14 miles to a gallon, and we need to double that. We need to triple that. We need to think about quadrupling that. And that way what you do is you take control of the direction of where you're going in the future.
What do you say to people who say we need to conserve, we need to get the CAFE standards up higher, but at the same time, we do need to drill for more oil? It's become a major push by the President of the United States right now to open up offshore drilling, and there's a lot of pressure on Congress to go along with it.
What do you say? I guess one of the things you need to do is put it in perspective relative to a timeline. How many years is it going to take for that offshore oil to be delivered? 8, possibly 10, 12? How long will it take for me to change the situation for myself relative to purchasing a higher efficiency vehicle? I can do that immediately.
Let's talk about what you've got at the fair this year to appeal to those who are looking for ways to avoid, mm-hmm. either avoid paying that $4 a gallon for gas or at least to get better gas mileage if they do pay it. I imagine there are always a lot of vehicles at the fair with a variety of solutions in terms of getting higher gas mileage. I imagine that's even more so this year.
Absolutely. We have our fourth annual Clean Energy Car Show this year featured right up next to the front gate. We have a number of vehicles featured, biodiesel cars, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, neighborhood electric vehicles, compressed natural gas. You can see these vehicles up close. So it ranges in what's available right now. What could you drive off the lot that would help you get better gas mileage. What might be coming down the pike 1 year from now, 2 years from now, so you can prepare yourselves and looking for a new vehicle. And also just kind of evaluating and learning. I think Mick was right on when he was talking about education. Learning about what are the impacts if we're moving to ethanol, what are those impacts going to be. So we have workshops, we have exhibitors, and then we have demonstration vehicles where you can see some of those solutions.
What about ethanol? Is it just driving up the price of corn and food and eliminating any price advantage to mixing it with gas?
I think there's a number of studies about that. I would say Mick and I are not the experts on ethanol and what the impacts are and balancing our food production and our food supply as well as our transportation. But there's nothing right now that would be the silver bullet that we can continue to consume and drive the way we're going doing what we're doing.
The other thing about this, Glenn, is there's a very interesting interrelationship between some of these things. You talked about ethanol. I just want to go back to petroleum for just a second to make a point. Petroleum costs are up. Very, very little electricity in the United States is generated by petroleum. It's generated, for the most part, by coal, nuclear, some natural gas. And yet, because of petroleum costs, there are pressures on all sorts of other. Everything is interconnected, and as a result, New York's electric rates, the state of New York's electric rates, at the end of the summer are going up 29%. Pennsylvania's going up 24%. These are major emergency measures that those states have put into place to relieve some pressure on the. On the utilities. You know, the same thing is happening in the fuels industry when we start taking a look at, okay, ethanol. What's the impact on ethanol and petroleum and transportation and food? Well, it doesn't just end there. It's also going to impact fertilizers. It's going to impact plastics. It's going to impact an awful lot of things that are inputs in our daily lives.
There's a new push for nuclear energy right now by many of the same people who are saying, well, it's clean. It doesn't generate carbon dioxide. It doesn't generate greenhouse gases. And I never thought I'd see in my lifetime a push for more nuclear energy, but it's happening.
It is happening. And I think the proponents are framing the arguments very, very narrowly, so that when you talk about there are no greenhouse gases from the generation of electricity by nuclear energy, well, that may be true, but what about the processing of the fuel? What about the construction of that plant? All of those things, when you take a look at life cycle costs and you don't look at things just linearly or just pick one incident out of a pile and evaluate it, all of those things are contributors. And when you look at all of those, nuclear does not stack up
and we haven't solved the problem of the nuclear waste either, which is radioactive for tens, maybe even hundreds of thousands of years.
There are people out there that say that nuclear fuels are actually going to run out before petroleum fuels will. I don't know the veracity of that, but I do know that it's a concern of it is a concern of the utility industry. There's something that they've been keeping an eye on for a while. That is not an infinite resource or a renewable resource either.
We're going to take a short break, Mick and Amy, and then we'll come back and talk about more of the specifics of what you have to offer at this year's Energy Fair. We're talking to Amy Hart and Mick Sagrillo of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, the Big Energy Fair, the 19th annual, this weekend in Custer, Wisconsin. And I want to remind you that Larry Mueller will be broadcasting live from the fair tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. You can hear his show right here on the Ideas Network, or you can get more information by logging on to WPR.org/WLBL. If you'd like to join the conversation, 261-6371, 261-6371, or toll free, 1-800-780-9742, 780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Those numbers again, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742 if you want to talk to Amy Hart and Mick Sagrillo of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association as the 19th annual Midwest Energy Fair, bigger and more significant than ever. They're through setting up, and it's ready to go for this coming weekend. And Mick and Amy, I saw a film recently called Who Killed the Electric Car? Now, it seems about 10 years ago we had significant numbers of all-electric plug-in vehicles on the streets and highways of California, but General Motors, according to this film, recalled them all and destroyed them. Why did they do that, and why aren't we making plug-in vehicles now?
Why did they do that? That's not a serious question, is it? Detroit, or you know, the oil companies. Obviously, that's competition. Why don't we see them now? I actually think that you might start seeing them again. And let me give you a couple of different areas where you may see this of interest. First of all, this is one location or one place where transportation fuels. And renewable electricity, for example, I told you my area of expertise is wind, might be coming together. My wife and I recently installed a wind turbine, a larger wind turbine that we need, and one of the reasons is because we're thinking down the road, I will never be able to generate gasoline on our farm. But I live in a very, very windy location, and I can generate electricity. Quite possibly in the next couple of years, there may be an electric vehicle that we can buy and charge with our wind generator at home. That's one thing. The other thing I have to tell you is that there are other people looking at this. People that have, I guess you'd call them the gorillas in the neighborhood, and those are the utilities. They are actually looking at electric vehicles that would be plug-in that they could charge with conventional fuels or whatever happens to be on the grid at night when they have excess capacity.
How easy is it to convert a hybrid Honda or a Toyota Prius into a plug-in vehicle?
Not necessarily easy, nor is it necessarily inexpensive. It tends to be a very, very expensive endeavor, although it can be done. I mean, there have been numbers of people that have done it. And it's quite a popular thing to do out in California, where they're paying a lot more for electric rates and a lot more for fuel than we are here in the Midwest.
Well, what sorts of electric vehicles, whether they're all electric plug-in or hybrids, will we see at the Energy Fair this weekend?
There are some example plug-in hybrids. We also have some example neighborhood electric vehicles, which that's where you're seeing the first sort of re-step, I guess, into the electric vehicles, and those are the ones that maybe will go 35, 40 miles per hour, and you plug them into your home. You can use them to run your regular errands and then plug them in at the end of the night. So you'll see a number of those. Also compressed natural gas, and a number of other different options.
You know, those neighborhood electric vehicles, a number of communities are taking the steps of licensing them right now. Marshfield is in the process of passing a law to make them legal. People compare them to golf carts, but they've got headlights, they've got turn signals, they've got airbags, they've got personal restraint devices. They're basically cars. They just don't go as fast, and they're a lot quieter, and they don't emit any gas emissions.
Exactly. And I think, again, part of it is that education and being able to talk to the experts who know about them, see the vehicles up close, whether it's the elected officials and the staff in municipalities that are making those decisions to allow them, or whether or not it's going to be the owners in the long term.
Mick, I'd like to talk to you about wind power for a second. Windmill farms have been opposed by homeowners, it seems, in a lot of the places that they've been proposed. Offshore in Massachusetts, for instance, near Horican Marsh, there's proposals to put them over the Great Lakes. How can you combat this not-in-my-backyard syndrome with people who just don't want to see them cluttering up the horizon?
I don't think you can combat it per se. I think what you can do is you can educate people. One of the problems that I see is that we are very, very far removed. As an American public, we are very far removed from the generation source of our of what we consume. Electricity, for example, people have no idea what goes on or what goes into, for example, a coal-fired power plant, nor do they know what's involved with mountaintop removal in the Appalachians, for example, in order to get to that coal, and how the environment is just being devastated and how it's ruining people's lives.
If you've ever heard the song Paradise by John Prine, or seen those satellite images of the huge scars across all of West Virginia and Appalachia,
yeah.
It's shocking. It's shocking that we're literally just removing the Appalachian Mountains in order to get to the coal underneath them.
And we're ultimately all responsible for that because we're all consumers of electricity. One of the things that happens when you bring that generating source close to home is it becomes visible, regardless of whether it's a coal-fired power plant or a nuclear power plant or a gas generator or a wind farm. And let me just digress for a second. And one of the criticisms that you hear about wind farms is that they're never going to be, you know, the wind does not blow continuously, so they're never going to take over. They're never going to take over a coal-fired power plant. Nobody's actually advocating that. When we're looking at renewable energy or any of any alternatives to what we are currently using, what we're actually looking at doing is diversifying that mix, adding to the inputs so that we are not necessarily dependent so heavily on one particular fuel, coal, for example.
Are we going to see solar panels in the desert of the Southwest? And again, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but same kind of dispute. They're talking about putting thousands of solar panels on the desert. Now there are complaints about the unsightly high-power transmission lines, which would run right across some scenic areas in the Southwest.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that people say that I hear all the time is you know, Wisconsin doesn't have a lot of wind. Let's put the wind turbines in North Dakota. Well, that would be great, except for the fact that North Dakota may as well be the Big Island of Hawaii. There is absolutely no extension cord coming from the island of Hawaii to the continental United States. There's no way of getting that electricity from North Dakota here. So then you go down that battle, and you've certainly done interviews with, you know, on the transmission line that's coming from Minnesota. Are we going to see, you know, solar arrays in the desert? You want my opinion? The answer is no. You know where you're going to see them? You're going to see them in Madison, Wisconsin, and you're going to see them in Marshfield, and you are going to see them in Milwaukee. And where you're going to see them is on people's roofs. Interestingly, one of the things that I do is I'm the wind specialist for Focus on Energy, and one of the technologies, that's the renewable energy program for the state of Wisconsin.
Right.
One of the technologies that we fund is PV, photovoltaic systems for people's rooftops. In the past 4.5, maybe 5 years, we have installed over a megawatt of PV in the state of Wisconsin, and it's been essentially in small systems on people's roofs. This is the change that we're going to be seeing.
And it's what you can see at the Energy Fair this weekend.
We're
down to our last 2 minutes, Amy, and I want you to talk about the speakers. You got Jim Hightower coming on Saturday.
We've got Jim Hightower Saturday at 1 o'clock. We have Torbjorn Lahti on Sunday at 1 o'clock, who's one of the instrumental founders of the eco-municipality movement in Sweden, which has moved over here to the Midwest. And on Friday, tomorrow, Jason Walsh is here from Green for All, which is going to talk about creating a green economy for Wisconsin and the rest of the Midwest and how this can help us all as we transition to a clean energy economy.
And again, Jim Hightower will be at 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. This is a real high-profile person who's been at the forefront of a lot of progressive change. He's a frequent guest on Wisconsin Public Radio. I imagine you've got a lot of people who are interested in that.
A lot of people are interested. He's going to be a big hit. And a lot of it is because he focuses a lot on the populist and the individual. And I think that's what's key about the Energy Fair. It's connecting individuals to get the education, to connect with the exhibitors, to learn about how they can implement clean energy, sustainable living in their own lives.
Amy Hart, Mick Sagrilla, thanks so much, and good luck on the Energy Fair this weekend.
Thank you,
Glenn. Thank you.
We do want to thank Amy and Mick and remind you that the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair is happening this weekend. in Custer, Wisconsin, Highway 10, about 7 miles east of Stevens Point. We also want to thank Matt Hauser of the Wisconsin Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association, who is with us on the first half of the show. Next week, we've got that live broadcast with the South Beach Chamber Ensemble. You'll want to attend that, if you can, at the UW Marathon County Theater. That's next Thursday at 5 o'clock, and we are completely out of time. A reminder, Larry Mueller's show originates from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association Fair tomorrow at 11 o'clock. I'm Glenn Mobrick. Thanks for riding with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town.